This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of The Culture Bunker. I'm Sian Pattinder.
And I'm Andrew Harrison. This week we are delighted to welcome the artist formerly known as the Big Nose Bard from Barking, Billy Bragg, whose new album is out today.
At the movies, guest Linda Marrick helps us untangle Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho.
And we've got the new albums from American alt-indie combo The War on Drugs and the Trébian compilation Pop Psychédélique, the best of French psychedelic pop, 1964 to 2019.
All this in today's Culture Bunker. Hello and welcome to the Culture Bunker, and hello to our very special guest. He is the Woody Guthrie of British folk, pop and roll, standard bearer of protest pop over four decades. He's also the author of The Progressive Patriot and Roots, Radicals and Rockers, The Story of British Skiffle. Curator of the Left Field at Glastonbury, and his new album, The Million Things That Never Happened, is out today, Friday the 29th of October. Hello and happy album day, Billy Bragg.
Good morning, and how fabulous it is to have the album out this morning. How lovely.
I hope it is an absolute relief for you to have it out in the world like a baby. Indeed, it's a bouncing, healthy 12-track album. How do you feel? Are you exhausted by the process already?
No, not really, because it's one of those weird things because of lockdown and everything. Mm-hmm. It seems to have gone on forever. You know, what I'm exhausted is trying to get the vinyl together. That's unfortunate. I'm not sure if it's because the container got stuck in the Suez Canal or Adele has put a record out this month, but all the vinyl in the UK has disappeared. So those of us who are more indie end of the market, we're having trouble getting our vinyl together. But the CD and the streaming and all those other things are all out there. So that's a plus. So I'm really excited about it. Everyone gets to hear it.
You are not the only pop star to moan about the vinyls, Billy. Yep, there's been a big backlog.
Yeah.
And you're on actual tour right now, Gateshead, Dundee. You're at the Philharmonic Hall this week as well. Did you pop over the road to see what Andrew assures me is the most beautiful pub toilets in Britain?
In the Philharmonic Rooms.
In Liverpool, yes.
I would have done, were it not for the fact that just opposite that, they've opened a Japanese ice cream parlour. I went in there instead, I'm afraid, Andrew. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. We were just getting on the van. And I just noticed that they had this place there, and I had some green tea ice cream for breakfast, which is not what I normally do, I'll be honest with you, but it's kind of in keeping with bit of the trip.
The old hometown has changed.
It has, and it's all lovely.
So how does it feel being back on the road after lockdown?
A little bit odd. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing I did this morning, I actually was doing it while we were trying to hook up, was I did one of these, which I have to send.
He's holding up a COVID test, people.
Yeah, and it's negative.
Yeah, I have to do this before I brush my teeth. So, you know, literally it's the first thing in the morning when I'm just, you know, you're bleary-eyed, sticking something up my nose. It's not the kind of rock star I thought I was. but yeah, we can't go into venues without a negative test. Mm-hmm. So it's fine. I'm kind of on it. But the downside, of course, is that if one of us does pick up the virus, I've got a crew of about five of us together on the road, we'll have to all go home. So we're really serious about getting in. And I'm pleased to say the venues are, you know, checking people who are double vaxxed or have a clear test. So it's really weird, though. You know, I'm in Birmingham at the moment. Mm-hmm. And as I don't know if you're aware, if you've ever driven around Birmingham, but it's impossible to drive around. So you're constantly about to cross the road and the car comes up the road and does a U-turn in front of you to get around some piece of thing. And every time I see that, I think, that's the virus, that is. That's the living virus trying to get around. It doesn't matter how many roadblocks you put in. The blooming virus is going to do a U-turn and get back in. So it keeps us on our toes.
Yeah, very metaphorical, very psychedelic, which we'll talk about later.
A singer-songwriter, I can't help it.
It's all material.
How are musicians suited, do you think, to things like 18 months of isolation? Some are and some aren't?
Yeah, some are and some aren't, yeah. I mean, it's the longest I've been home since my 20s, really. And it was revelatory to me. I found out a number of really exciting things. Firstly, my hair parts the opposite direction to the way I've always combed it, because it got so long and unkempt during the lockdown that it took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And also, my partner and I, we discovered that we actually really like each other.
Oh, well, that's lovely.
Yeah, that was revelatory. Yeah, it was. I mean, apart from the year our son was born, when I took a year out for that, but that was more like an assault call. So it wasn't really the place where you refine your relationship. That was more like playing past the baby. Yeah. So it's been cool. And also, I now know what the floor looks like in our basement because I've cleared it out. So some positive things have happened.
Well, it does sound quite positive. I like it. We're going to talk to you about the new album a little bit more later, making protest pop in a country that seems to get more divided, and the ways and opinions of young people and more. But we do have another guest, don't we, Andrew?
We certainly do. Also joining us, Linda Marrick is a film critic for Hey You Guys, the BFI, the Jewish Chronicle, the Mirror, the NME. Is there anybody she doesn't review films for? Hi, Linda, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm fine. How are you?
All right, not bad. So you've just finished the assault course, that is, the London Film Festival. What were the highlights? Give us the edited bullet points of the top things of the LFI.
I have to say, the programme itself, I wasn't as excited about it as I have been in the past, but of the films that I've seen some really good ones. For example, the new Jane Campion film, which is a lovely Western, beautiful, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Fantastic movie. It's called The Power of the Dog. I can see everyone in that film getting an Oscar nomination.
How is Benedict Cumberbatch's Wild West accent? Is it plausible?
Very, very good. I wasn't sure to start with. It took me like 5-10 minutes, and then his acting just made up for it. He is fantastic in that. And Jesse Plemons is also in it. But I mean, Jesse Plemons is in everything. I liked Jacques Audiard's new film, French movie called Les Olympiades. I think in English it's called the 13th District, like 13e arrondissement. And a few bits and pieces, you know, that I kind of, you know, I wouldn't say it's like a vintage year, but, you know, it's good. It's all right.
It's amazing they managed to pull it off at all.
Before we crack on, a tiny reminder. Remember, you can get The Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without adverts when you support The Bunker on Patreon. That means episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much more every day. Plus, because we are innovators like Mark Zuckerberg, we've got a new benefit for Patreon people. You can suggest a tune for us to play in clip form on the show. If there's a great record on a smaller independent label that you love and who might give us permission, then suggest it in the comments to this show on the Patreon page and post a link to the song. Now, please, little reminder, don't say the Rolling Stones or Joni Mitchell. There's no point. We're not going to do the dinosaurs, but we'll see what we can clear and play. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
Right then, this Bragg fella, The Million Things That Never Happened, is his 10th-ish album, depends what you count. It's a record of pandemic blues produced by Romeo Stoddart for the Magic Numbers, and it features a song co-written with his son, Jack Valero. My dad made me go to work with him as well. We're going to talk about it, politics, life, the universe and everything after that particular track co-written with Jack. It's called 10 Mysterious Photos That Can't Be Explained. Billy, tell us a bit about it. Writing with the lads.
Oh, it's really about, you know, the way the internet can drag you down a rabbit hole. And more so during the pandemic when we had some downtime. I'm not one of those people who thinks the internet is terrible. I mean, what would the lockdown have been without it? It would have been a nightmare. But I think, you know, it reflects who we are. It reflects all human life. So there's good and bad there. But there was actually a website called 10 Mysterious Photos That Can't Be Explained. I think it was a YouTube video. Yeah. And I kept looking at it for days thinking, I know they're not mysterious. I know that they're going to be relatively easily explained. You know, it's light refracting off the sea. It's a man in a monkey suit. Eventually I had to go there and I thought, well, this is, you know, there's something here in this for me. So I wrote the song and then my son came along and corrected it for me, like he was correcting my homework. So that was a bit of a... He thought that the first B part should be the chorus. And I was like, oh, God, you know, it's like repointing the entire song. So he took it away and he messed around with it. He came back and he said, look, like this. He played it to me. And actually, frustratingly, it was much better, which is really annoying to have your song sort of fixed by someone who can't even get it together to empty a dishwasher regularly.
It's really
but it was good fun. I was really pleased he did it because he's been writing songs for years, Jack. And often, you know, he plays them to me and I try and be encouraging because they're really good songs. But to actually write together, that's a new thing for us. So, and he came and played on the record as well. So it was really sweet. I loved it. He loved it. But his mum loved it most of all.
Fantastic. Well, let's have a listen. This is 10 Mysterious Photos That Can't Be Explained. I've been down rabbit holes. I've seen the rabbit trolls cackling in the twilight of the age of reason. One thing I've noticed as I get older, common sense like art
is in the eye of the beholder. Not a new breed of now, nothing's a flood in my screen. Not a scheme, it is so goddamn sure. They look like me.
Finishing your pandemic album on an up tune, that's a good idea. You could quite easily have finished on quite a depressing one there, because it's the last track of the album, isn't it?
You need a bit of a knees up, don't you, to close on that? I mean, I've tried to write an album that doesn't focus on the pandemic, but the pandemic's the backdrop of it.
Yeah.
So there is some, you know, I'm trying to get on to how we feel about it and things like that. I mean, that's what the title track, The Million Things That Never Happened. I think once this is over, we're going to have a sense of loss for the things that we couldn't do. And for some of them, some of us, rather, they'll just be, you know, social things. We couldn't hang out with our mates or maybe have a holiday or something. But for some people, it's going to be really deep personal things, like not being able to be there when someone passes away or to be able to console people who've lost someone. So I think it's going to be, that's going to linger a long time after this thing's over.
Yeah, I mean, something that's made me think, it's just like I'm trying to not say I'll do it next time, because you never know if there's going to be one.
Yeah, exactly. You really need to seize the day. I mean, there's another track on there called Pass It On, which refers to, you know, asking your elders for the family stories before they too disappear. Because I did a bit of, I'm a bit of a family history buff in my spare time, and I put together a family history for my wife's family, but only because we inherited all the stuff from her mum and I had all the photos and everything. But of course, with her mum not being there to ask, the kids were all like, our mum used to know this stuff. And it really made me think, if only I'd had time to sit down with Maggie and maybe go through some of this.
Yes.
It would have saved me a lot of, you know, having to guess about what, you know, where things fit together. So yeah, there's that in there as well. I mean, it's more of a, it's a more reflective album and not quite so capital P political. But I think, you know, you can't just pull that sort of thing on the pandemic and expect to come out the other side with people recognising what you're talking about. You've got to sort of change the position from what you're looking at it in order to connect with what is fundamentally a universal experience rather than the normal situation for a songwriter like me where I'm trying to get the audience to come and check out this thing I'm writing about.
Yes.
You know, it's a universal thing. You're going to have to write an album that connects with as many people as possible.
A lot of people saw the kind of early days of the pandemic as a real vindication of communal spirit. And in a lot of ways, it's the stuff you've always sung about, kind of, you know, coming true before our eyes. People supporting the NHS, NHS's finest hour, applause in the streets. That seems not to have lasted. Do you think that we kind of learned new things about Britain during the course of the pandemic? Maybe some things that we perhaps will not find quite so comfortable.
Yeah, one of the things we learned during the pandemic is people in London are mad. If you go in the supermarket the supermarket where I live in West Dorset, in Morrison's, 85% of people still wearing masks because they're still thinking about the pandemic, still concerned for their health, but for everybody else's health as well. I'm always encouraged by that. But coming up to London last week and realising that people don't seem to be doing that anymore, I don't know if it's predominantly younger people who think they're immortal, but you can't get rid of this thing by ignoring it. You know, you get rid of this thing by all of us doing things that we normally wouldn't do. I mean, you know, the last thing I would do first thing in the morning is stick something up my nose and go through that whole bloody thing. But I know, it's for the common good. And I think at certain times, you know, individual freedom is absolutely key to a free society. But sometimes you have to lean the other way towards the idea of the common good. And I think people have forgotten that. This isn't over. If anything, you know, their cases are still coming at us. Yeah. And I don't think it's over until the immunocompromised can go back to their normal lives. Until then, I'm more, you know, for every annoyed anti-vaxxer out there with their slogans, there are 10 people who can't come out because people like that won't wear a mask in Sainsbury's. So that's where my solidarity is with those people. And I think we still need to fight this thing. It's not over. Unfortunately, I wish it was, but unfortunately, it's not over yet.
There is a fun little hoedown on the album called Freedom Doesn't Come for Free on this very theme about personal freedom versus sort of shared freedom. It's about libertarians building a kind of a town free of legal enforcement in New Hampshire, containing the, I thought, particularly entertaining lines, live free or die trying, you might get eaten by a mountain lion. You know, are you surprised that these mad ideas that in the 80s we thought were kind of dead, libertarianism is kind of petering out, are now not just back, but they're kind of shaping world politics?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what's happened in the last sort of 5 or 6 years in the rise of people like Donald Trump and Boris Johnson is another good example of a libertarian idea that it's not a political idea about a free society. It's an individualist idea about acting with impunity. And, you know, not all freedom is good. There are some freedoms that are downright dangerous. And most dangerous of all is impunity. When you're dealing with someone, whether it's running a country or in a relationship, when you're dealing with someone who acts with impunity, who has no responsibility whatsoever, who refuses to be held accountable for their behaviour, that's a really dangerous time. So I think that particular strain of libertarianism, the one that really boils down to you're not the boss of me, you know, nothing else, just an absolute refusal to accept any constraints. I find that irresponsible in terms of the pandemic, but downright dangerous in terms of running a society. So, yeah, it's something that I thought a lot about. I wrote a book called Three Dimensions of Freedom, which argues that in order to really be free, you need not just liberty and equality, but accountability. And I don't think there's enough of that around. So, you know, we need to have that as our kind of red line so that society doesn't just break down into selfishness and, you know, every person for themselves.
You and I are in similar age groups. You're early 60s, I'm mid 50s. Our contemporaries, it's often like the ex-punks, the ex-mods, the working class music fans who maybe don't get as much of a look in now. They're the ones who are the Brexiters. Does it trouble you? In a way, it's kind of, I'm not saying it's your audience, but it's the world of music that you've been in has actually, a lot of people didn't seem to learn the lessons of it.
Yeah, I think you have to look at, first thing I have to say, music can't change the world. So you can't expect songs to have that effect on people's behaviour.
Now he tells us.
Listen, if anyone knows, it's me, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Yeah. I'm not saying don't try. I mean, I'll keep pushing, but my experience is it doesn't. I think the root of the problem is people no longer feel they have any agency over their lives. You know, they don't feel as if they're in control. Power is exercised a long way away, whether it's in Parliament or in the corporate headquarters somewhere in another country. They kind of get angry. They lash out. You know, Brexit was a demand for more accountability to bring decision making closer. And we live in England. We live in the most centralized country in Europe. We have no devolution to speak of. And I think we really need to be giving people the sense that they have some control over their lives. And I think that would ease things up a little bit, because at the moment, I think, you know, I can't imagine the people who voted in such numbers for Brexit were doing it for any other reason, because they realised that with one vote, they would get something. Just that one vote, they would get a result. And they had one opportunity to do that, so they might as well do it. Come on, let's just do it. Whereas the people who wanted to stay were thinking, we would never be so stupid as to leave the European Union, because, you know, who signs up a trade deal that puts up more barriers? Yeah. Nobody does that. And here we are. So I don't blame those angry people, because they have been shafted, particularly after all these years of austerity. But I do think we need to resolve that by giving them more say over their lives, more control over their lives. And none of the political parties seem to be looking at that at the moment.
One thing that has happened in the past sort of 10, 15 years is that music has become astonishingly middle class. It's full of people who all went to the same rather expensive schools.
Who can afford to do it.
People who can afford to do it, yeah. Could a Billy Bragg happen today? Or would he come from a very posh school and yet somehow still have the name Billy? Because posh people have working class names now, don't they?
No, he'd probably be Quinton Bragg. Or Melvin, maybe.
right.
I'm sorry about that, because, you know, music always was a great escape route for working class kids who, you know, left school at 16 and didn't have many prospects, but were smart. I mean, if you look at me and Weller and that generation, you know, John Lydon, we were all kids who didn't really, we were smart kids, but we just didn't get on with school. We were smart in other ways. And that pop music has always had a place for them, but it seems to have dried up. It's much more difficult to get hold of that now. And I worry that the pandemic is going to make it more difficult, because those small venues are absolutely crucial to people learning their trade and building an audience. They're the ones who are most likely not to survive the pandemic. So I can only see it becoming more difficult, particularly with political songwriting. You don't really need to learn to sing now to express your view. You only really need a social media platform. So I think fewer kids are thinking, I'm so angry about the world. Like me, you know, the only medium available to me when I was 19, if I wanted my voice to be heard, was to learn to play guitar, write songs, do gigs. Now, you know, you can do all sorts of things. So I think it's really, those people are out there, they're still angry, but they're more involved in direct activism now. And that's a good thing in itself.
Before we move on, how's Labour doing? How do you feel about Keir Starmer?
One of the problems I had with Jeremy Corbyn was his politics were a bit 20th century. He didn't grasp the nuances of devolution, you know, which is a Labour Party policy. You know, he didn't really have a grasp about the idea of England as a political entity, which I think is really necessary to marginalise the ethno-nationalists. I'm seeing the same with Starmer, you know. I worry that 80% of Labour Party branches put forward the notion of proportional representation that the party should make that its policy. Starmer and his people shot that down. They're not going for a £15 minimum wage. They're wishy-washing around £10 like the Tories are. There's a load of people out there who didn't want Brexit who don't seem to have anyone to represent them. Nobody's articulating where we are all at the moment, and we just seem to be standing there watching the whole thing crumble. Every day there's another thing, the sewage, the drivers, the shelves empty. You know, every day there's something, the fishermen now. Every day there's something else. Where's the political party standing up saying this is an absolute travesty, it's a complete mistake, this has just been done to benefit British capital? What are we going to do and put this back together again? Nobody's doing it. The Labour Party, I know they... I'm not saying they should just do this because they're the opposition, but they should be able to put out policies that connect with people who have those feelings. And I don't see it. And I'm really disappointed in that. You know, I can't see it change anything at the next election. Brexit is the elephant in the room. Brexit is the Tories' shield, you know, that's going to stop them from being thrown out of power because they own it. And the sooner we make people understand what a travesty it is, the sooner they're going to see through what the Tories are doing and we can get some change. But at the moment, I don't see it on the horizon.
All right, let's have some pop music. We always ask our guests to bring a tune in for your listening pleasure, and this week Linda Marrick has chosen hers. What have you chosen, Linda?
It's The New Placebo and Beautiful James. And I used to absolutely love Placebo about 10, 15 years ago. And I enjoyed everything they put out. And listening to this again brought up so many memories. And I just think it sounds absolutely beautiful.
Well, we can play this one. We have clearance. And of course, it's on our rolling playlist. So here it is, Placebo, Beautiful James.
And it's exactly why I stay. Beautiful James, I don't want to wake you. Beautiful James, I don't want to wake you.
Right, so to the movies. Edgar Wright's latest flick is released on this Halloween weekend, which is certainly no coincidence. Thomasine McKenzie, Anya Taylor-Joy and Matt Smith star in horror thriller Last Night in Soho that takes the idea of London's swinging 60s and aims to render it entirely unswung. Also featuring appearances by Terence Stamp, Rita Tushingham and Diana Rigg. You get a theme here. Will young fashion student Ellie conquer her demons as she moves from Cornwall to London, armed with a suitcase of Cilla Black and Petula Clark vinyls? Let's listen to the trailer first.
Last night, I had a dream. There was a girl. I got this kind of gift.
And you are?
Sandy. I can see people, places.
So I'll see you again.
You know where to find me. But they're not just dreams. They really happened.
What did you see, Daisy?
A girl murdered.
You witnessed the murder last night. You believe this was a vision.
Jack, I don't want to do this.
You think you can just walk away?
Believe in ghosts.
Save yourself.
Linda Marrick, I'm going to start with you. As we stated, Ellie moves to the city but is haunted at first by a mean girls troupe of fellow fashion students as she's studying fashion in the present day, but also she's haunted by memories of a young woman called Sandy who is adrift in 60s London. Is this, like it sounds, a film of many parts?
It isn't the film you think it's going to be, but more importantly, I think if you don't really know Edgar Wright's sort of credentials, if you're not too sure about where he's coming from horror-wise,
yes.
I think this will really throw you. And I think, I know, Andrew, you said you were really thrown in by how it developed. And I really love that. I think that's kind of pernicious. I think that's really naughty of him to sort of lure in people thinking they're going to see this film about the swinging 60s, all singing, all dancing, all sort of downtown and Cilla Black. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly sort of throwing them into this kind of almost like Dario Argento horror movie. And I love that. I love that about him. I think it's a very clever way of inviting a bigger sort of a more mainstream audience into something so cult. It's a film about the seediness of London, about how no matter how clean you think it is now, if you scratch a little bit, the seediness is still there. And I'm so impressed. I think this is his best movie. His best sort of fictional movie so far, because I really liked the Sparks Brothers film as well.
It's also about the rotten core of nostalgia, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
But this is not a spoiler, but we are introduced to the world of the 1960s is beautifully recreated. 1960, so I was kind of slightly verging on tears. It was so beautiful, the nostalgia for that time, that we all love for the musical, we all love for the films. We are like Ellie, the central character, totally reeled in by this. Mm. And then your expectations are completely confounded, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not swinging. It's definitely the sort of the most horrendous part of the 60s, which is the exploitation of young women who've come to the city to sort of and looking for stardom, looking to become the next Cilla Black or the next Sandy Shaw, and they are taken advantage of and find themselves surrounded by these creepy old men wanting things from them. And I really admire the subject. And I think it's co-written by a female screenwriter,
Christy Wilson-Cairns.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think she had a lot. I mean, but then again, he is someone. I think this is his very first movie to be sort of told from a female point of view, which I looked back and surprisingly, yes, it is. He's always had this kind of ideas of bringing in sort of old 60s female stars into his films. And here he does it again with Diana Rigg, who is fabulous in it. And it's her last movie. And I mean, he dedicates the movie to her as well. I mean, I think there's so many levels to this film, and it's I've seen it twice now, and the more you watch it, the more you discover, new things about it. And I just loved it.
Andrew, what were your thoughts about it?
Well, like I say, I was completely disorientated when I first saw it. But the more I thought about it since, the more I like it. Mm-hmm. I think it is actually, it is ridiculous in the best way. It overreaches itself brilliantly and kind of lands it, I think. It's not a perfect film. The present day cast is, the performances and the style of presentation are very, very, very broad brush. The Mean Girls are incredibly broadly drawn. Ellie herself is not a fabulous character, I don't think, and it's not a fabulous performance. Mm-hmm. And her kind of sounding board potential boyfriend, I think the phrase that we talked about, the phrase we used a lot on the way out of the screening was CBBC, didn't we?
Well, he's the manic pixie dream boy.
He is, yeah.
And that is entirely compliant, and even though she is quite accusatory towards him, he goes along with it and
absolutely
still in love with her.
Because the rest of it is so ambiguous, and there's such a lot of darkness and there's such a lot of subtlety in the performances. I have to conclude that that CBBC is a choice, that the banality of the present day versus the dark complexity of the past is a directorial choice, that's what he's trying to say. The film rests upon the allure of nostalgia and the fact that even those who went around at the time have a kind of societal love of the 1960s when somehow everything was better, and this goes into it and shows you how it absolutely wasn't. It could be a horror show, and especially for women, and especially in Soho, it was a hellhole. That sort of juxtaposition I thought worked really well. But the film does manage to have its cake and eat it, absolutely, because the staging of the 1960s is so lush and so beautiful, and the musical numbers are so incredible. The production design is fantastic. Matt Smith is a great villain. The core of it, though, is that Ellie is literally experiencing visions. Mm-hmm. She literally is incapable of being able to distinguish reality from imagination, and whether what the one is bleeding into the other.
Yeah.
We're never quite sure whether this is a supernatural experience or whether it's all happening in her head. We're never quite sure in parts where it's induced by whether it's induced by drugs or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the ambiguity of the film. And when it goes into these insane, lurid, over-the-top special effects sequences, hallucinatory, that is, of course, immensely in theme with 1960s movies, which didn't quite have the special effects wherewithal to bring that stuff to life. And yet I think he uses it really well.
Well, the film references many films, a few of which, Peeping Tom, references a lot of Hitchcock, and Hitchcock didn't have CGI, but Hitchcock dream sequences are fantastic. You are drawn in. I don't think they're in any way clunky. Is this a sort of film that you would go and see, Billy, on a day off of your tour?
It is, actually, yeah. Yeah, we do tend to try to go see, on a night off, have a curry and go and see a movie. And we try and spread it around so it's not all one kind of movie. Last time we were in Liverpool on tour, the previous time from this in the field, we had a 26-year-old pedal steel guitar player with us, lovely guy, CJ Hillman. And we were walking down to the cinema to watch The Death of Stalin, and he just said, "Who was Stalin then?"
Oh my God.
So we had a kind of long conversation. Wow. But then and then off worse to that, he's totally not into football. We made him come to see the Maradona movie. But he got his own back by we all had to go and see Once Upon a Time in America, and I can't stand Tarantino because of the body count. But here's the thing. It's full of American cars, which CJ loves. So we all went to see it with him. And I'm loving the movie and thinking, oh, actually, this is actually a really good Tarantino movie until the end when he gets that flamethrower and kills everyone. I'm like,
spoilers, Bill.
Done it to me again.
I agree.
Democratic film watching for the whole crew, so it doesn't all be the sort of film I wanted to be. But that certainly was one of the ones I was looking at when I walked past the Birmingham Odeon yesterday, looking at the movies that are on for a night off.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Billy, I think on that last tour that you just mentioned, your keyboard player may well have been Kenny Dickinson, who did our theme tune, which the listeners
Kenny,
just heard.
Indeed. Yeah, there you go. The wonderful Kenny, yeah.
Small world, mate. Sean, what did you think of Last Night in Soho?
Oh, I love the middle. Yeah. Actually, I love it. Yeah, when there is a blur between reality and fantasy, when it becomes horror, there may be a couple of zombies in it. Who knows? Mm. The idea that it is about a fear of predatory men and about vulnerability and two sides of the same coin is Ellie as this very young, very, very vulnerable fashion student and Sandy, whom she conjures up, who is worldly to a certain extent and glamorous and seems to know Soho and has ambition and some sort of female power, and yet we see that the way it gets jumbled up, the way there is paranoia, I mean, this is essentially, I think, someone having a nervous breakdown. This is a woman on the verge of. That I found really interesting, but topped and tailed by what we're now calling the CPPC element, I found quite jarring. And that's the problem I have had thinking about it and living with it for a few days. You liked it. I've now found it jarring.
You know, within 10 minutes, you're watching an episode of Doctor Who. You're watching an actual blood splatter horror movie. You're watching an hallucination scene. You're watching a kind of a school drama on CBBC.
But something soundtracked to Cilla Black, whom I absolutely adore and always wave the flag for Cilla Black. You know.
Yeah, natural born Cilla. That's you. Yeah.
Is there any, it seems to me, talking about the central character, not knowing if she's in reality and drifting in and out of this dream state, I think it's very timely with the stuff going on about young women being spiked at venues.
It seemed really prescient.
In Oxford 2 nights ago, after the show, I came out and there was women in the streets demonstrating against certain nightclubs where they believe this, they tolerate this kind of thing. So, I mean, I haven't seen the film, but it seems very timely.
Well, without giving too much away, that particular bell might be rung at a certain point. Yeah.
And the idea that the 60s, there is this dark heart. We don't see it enough. We know that. But it's in novels and it's in fiction, but not always on the screen.
Another thing I thought was great about it is that this film is not appearing in isolation. Obviously, I loved Mad Men, but the world was full of people getting the wrong end of the stick with Mad Men. Wasn't it great in those days? No, it wasn't. It was a hell, particularly for women, but also for the men involved. It takes that sort of superficial fascination with, look at the sharp suits and the collars. And also the fact that Ellie is very much kind of Mojo Reader dream girl, isn't she? Oh, she's into proper music with vinyl. She's not into the rubbish they listen to now, the rappers and the synthesizers. She likes proper stuff.
She's a crate digger.
And that, she's a crate digger. And yet that itself is also interrogated pretty quite mercilessly, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot in it, as we are saying. I think we are broadly recommending, aren't we?
You get a lot of bang for your buck.
I think if you discount what you thought was more like CBBC acting, then I didn't have a problem with that because I kind of really love those actors. And I think Thomasin McKenzie is a very good actress. There have been some sort of people who are not convinced by her delivery here, but I think she's wonderful, generally. I think she's a wonderful actress, young, you know.
Yeah. Before we move on, Linda, a film swat that you are, give us a couple of films to watch. Apparently you've seen Marvel's The Eternals already.
I have, yes. So this is the first Marvel movie that isn't about, the characters that we know already. So this is considered the sort of fourth level of the Marvel story.
Phase 4.
Phase Four, yeah. And it's directed by Chloe Zhao, who I'm sure, Billy, you probably have seen this film called Nomadland, mm-hmm. that won the Oscar last year. So you understand what kind of director she
right.
is. She's an indie director, mm-hmm. very fussy, sort of, you know, stripped down. And she's been given this big Hollywood superhero movie to work with. And the result, I'm afraid, are not very good. I was not convinced by this at all. I think the CGI is absolutely horrendous. I mean, the casting is kind of okay. And I totally understand what she was trying to do with the film. I totally understand she was trying to sort of give them more to talk about. You know, there's a lot of sitting down and talking and sorting out problems rather than fighting.
Right.
And for the first time ever, you know me, for the first time ever in a Marvel movie, I basically thought to myself, actually, no, can we have a bit more fighting, more explosions? Because this is boring as fuck. Sorry, it was really boring. It's probably not the worst Marvel movie ever, but it's it is getting okay. there.
Oh, you know? Dear. All Don't right. put that on the poster.
Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's not just the guests that get to choose a tune for your attention. We do too, now and again. A Certain Ratio, the great Manchester institution and contemporaries of New Order, are back and sounding pretty fantastic actually at the moment. Their trademark percussion mad electronic funk is very much back in focus in 2021. Next week they release a remix album of their Loco LP, in which today's modern young groovers get their hands on the tracks from ACR's Modern Incarnation. The album's called Loco Remezclada. I pronounced that very badly, but I'm giving it a try. It includes reels by Maps, Scream, The Orioles, plus also Graham Massey from 808 hey. State for the old people. I'm going to go and see them on Sunday. Yeah. It's also got the late and much-loved Denise Johnson on it. This track is a real standout from the record. It's Lone Ladies chop and drop mix of Bouncy Bouncy, and it sounds like Parliament, so have a listen.
Right, Billy, you. Let's stick with hot recommendations. Billy Bragg, you've selected a current favourite tune too. The curse of music clearance strikes again. We can't play it, but we can put it on our playlist. But what is it and why do you like it?
Yeah, I've chosen 17 Going Under by Sam Fender from his new album, which is also titled 17 Going Under. I like Sam. I think he's one of the young generation. I wouldn't call them writing political songs, but they're writing about the pressure that young people feel under, and I think that's enough. You know, mm-hmm. I don't expect them to be writing like I was during the 80s in that Capital P political, because they were Capital P political times, they were ideological times.
Mm.
Now I think the pressure that young people feel is much more diffuse, it's much harder for them to get focused on, but he's clearly trying to write about that. And 17 Going Under really reminds me when I was 17, when I just left school. He talks about getting into fights, he talks about, there's a great line in it where he says, you know, I didn't fight him at the time, but if I was there now, I was far too scared to hit him, but I would hit him in a heartbeat now. You know, I can remember thinking back to my times when they're dealing with the local bullies. That I wished I had that time back again. God knows what I would do. But I just think that he's trying to get to grips with it. He's not trying to sell people an idea that everything's cool. Again, he's come from a similar background to mine. Maybe it's more grit in what he's doing. But yeah, respect to him for trying to do that.
In some circles, they're calling him the new Billy Bragg. Are you digging your own pot grave here, William?
No one should have that cross to bear. The thing is, when you're the only person who wrote about those kind of political things, you end up being a bit stereotyped, and people always use you as a point of reference. You know, on those weird days We all have them, and I'm Googling myself, as you do, after brushing my teeth and testing my COVID. I usually find myself, it's usually me being used as a point of reference for some poor kid who's trying to be a singer-songwriter.
Oh.
I really feel sorry for him. Oh. So, you know, I think he could be the new Bruce Springsteen. He's got that kind of big voice.
Mm-hmm.
Not new Springsteen, but he's more up that end of the pop pantheon, really. He's going for those really great, I was thinking he's a bit of U2 in the way he sings as well. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad thing in my book. You know, we can't all be, you know, sort of solo singer songwriters, but he can do that as well. I've seen him do that as well. So good luck to him. Yeah, I hope he has a good go with this record.
Fabulous. Sam Fender and 17 Going Under. All right, in the meantime, just say non. You're going to get it in a minute, everybody. Grammy Award winning The War on Drugs, Adam Granduciel's plaintive and yet stadium-filling US rock band releases 6th studio album, I Don't Live Here Anymore, today. We also have retro psychedelic pop compilation Maison Acide, anyone? In the form of Pop Psychedelique, which features tracks from Brigitte Bardot and Jean-Jacques Perry to Stereolab and the Luminanas. Sadly, the curse of music clearance means we can't play The War on Drugs, but we'll drop Change into the rolling playlist. And from Pop Psychedelique, Le Fil Se Fait Pour Faire L'Amour by Charlotte Leslie. Let's start by discussing The War on Drugs, not the real War on Drugs, the band. Latest album, I Don't Live Here Anymore, was recorded in upstate New York in the snow and is released this weekend. So if you like your rock alt, your Grammys won and your heart on your sleeve, this is going to be your thing. I'm not going to lie, this is soft rock for people who may find the Flaming Lips a bit too edgy. Billy Bragg, what were your thoughts?
All a bit 1980s, wasn't it? I thought, I'm not familiar with their general thing, but I get the idea of them a bit more being a bit more acoustically, a bit more winsome, maybe that's not the right word. But when it started with the acoustic guitar track, I thought, okay, this is cool. I see in what my concept of what they do is, I understand that. Next thing I'm like, doo, 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 doo. The next track comes in, it's like this big. I mean, we were in the van, obviously, so I was sharing it with everybody in the van, and we were kind of back with Duran Duran somewhere. Now, I understand. Young people tell me that sound is very fashionable at the moment, so I don't wish to pour piss on what they're doing, because, as I say, I'm not, you know, I'm not au fait with exactly what's fashionable at the moment. But it did seem to me to be an odd-sounding record from that particular band. So it may be that people who have been to them will be thinking, oh, this is interesting, or be thinking, oh, maybe I just listen to Phil Collins.
There's a fair bit of Phil Collins to be found, yes.
Yes, there may be. And The Cars, I thought of, too, which is obviously an 80s influence. This is Americana, and this is Americans reflecting on the idea of Americana and songs about Americana sung by Americans. Do we need this reflection? Does we as British people get this, Billy?
Well, I think Americana is a very broad thing. I mean, I am classified as Americana now. And
yeah,
I think that's part of
your new album.
I did that Woody Guthrie thing with Wilco. I've worked with Joe Henry, who's a classic Americana producer. And I went to the Americana Music Awards, and they explained to me, you know, just to get my head around it, it's basically music, new music made that is using music, roots music from America. So it's very, very broad, you know, gospel, souls, all sorts of music. And certainly, you know, I fit into that. I have a huge love of American soul music and gospel music. And so, yeah, I imagine it does fit into that. But generally, the cutoff point for Americana is usually the 60s.
Right.
This is a more 80s record. So maybe they've shifted the idea of what Americana is while I was out in the pandemic. I don't know. But I wouldn't have expected to find this in the Americana section, this particular album.
I'm calling it Americana because to me it seems like ages ago, and this is that new alt kind of Americana, which then maybe, gets a few Lindrums in. Andrew, is this your sort of thing? Because I'm imagining, with so many guitars, a mi fu, as I can't say, guitars, one on top of another, on top of another track, but another track. This isn't quite your thing.
This one isn't. I'd like their earlier stuff, he said, boringly, when they used to cite Mega Dream Pop.
Smoking your chin, I'm
into my own early stuff. When they first appeared, they sounded like a better adjusted Joy Division or like a My Bloody Valentine with tunes, grand sweeps, lots of kraut, lots of motoric on the go, very hallucinatory. That first album, Lost in the Dream, it was that kind of doped out space pop reverie area that I really enjoy. And you mentioned the Flaming Lips. It had a foot in that camp. They went a bit more cosmic yacht rock on the next record. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But to me, this is a real turn to the conventional, and I find it dull. I can't get excited by the reiteration of things we've heard many, many times before in the mega guitar area. I'm not saying that it's all like that. There is stuff on here that is good. It's a track called Harmonia's Dream which mm-hmm. is like Jerry Garcia singing over Can, which would be, you know, great fun. And the clue's in the title, Harmonia, you know, that he really gets into that churning, repetitive, mind-cancelling stuff that is basically the rock version of house music, isn't it? That track, I think Billy alluded to it a minute ago, I Don't Want to Wait, it's basically In the Air Tonight, which is going great. And then it turns into Foreigner, and which, you know, don't mix your meds too much there. I found it painfully earnest. And he is dealing with important real stuff about the tragic direction of America. And there are tunes here about his old neighborhood's getting knocked down and losing its soul. And the fact that people who consider themselves on the progressive end of things are completely turned around and bamboozled right now. There's nothing for us to hold on to. It's important, real stuff, but it's delivered in such an earnest way. In sharp contrast to Billy, who's always funny, even when he's singing about miserable stuff. It's always there's always amusing little bits of wordplay that give you...
I think the word you're looking for, Andrew, is wry. I think it's the word.
Wry, right. Yeah, there you go.
And wit as well. Yeah, I mean, is there
funny,
any wit in
I'm
this?
I'm trying to be wry.
Yeah. Sorry, Billy, you're trying to be wry, but you end up being funny.
If you come and see me, you do get more laughs than an average Paul Weller gig, but I don't think
it's not a competition.
Yeah, but you know, I think a humour and wryness, if you want to call it that, is essential to get through this stuff. And there's vanishingly little of it on this record, I'm afraid. So I wasn't sold.
Yes, I did write earnest and sincere down fairly early.
Yeah,
in
your favourite Femme Sisters. Yes.
Linda, there's also lots of stuff about fatherhood. He is father to a 2-year-old called Bruce, named after Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, I mean...
What did you feel?
It's funny that you say that, because for me it was Bruce Springsteen, U2, Toto, you know, all of those. And I've heard those. I don't really need to hear more of those. And is their sixth album? Is that what you said?
Yes, I believe so. Fifth or sixth studio album.
You know, I think they have completely passed me by, and in all honesty, I have zero interest in this band, and even less now with this album. Having listened to Billy's album just before that, that is for me proper Americana. This isn't an Americana. This is trying to emulate sort of older stuff that we've all heard before. It might actually work on younger listeners, but for me, it didn't work, and I didn't feel it like it was Americana anyway.
So are we going to be dusting down our Czech shirts?
I don't own one.
He's going to be buying a Czech shirt.
I mean, yeah, no, I don't discount the sort of importance of what they're saying, of what he's saying. But at the same time, it doesn't move me in any way, because it doesn't, I don't feel touched by any of the subjects. And that's that. I mean, who hasn't, every single singer-songwriter has written about fatherhood. He's not the first or the last, and there's going to be plenty more to come. So, you know.
Billy's nodding sagely there. So.
Absolutely. We all have. Even I've written about fatherhood.
Good for you.
And on to Sous l'Epave, La Psychedelia. This stuff is resurging thanks to soundtracks from, like, The Serpent, Queen's Gambit and Killing Eve. Would you believe it? We also had Johnny Trunk on the show.
Yes.
I mean, Loungecore is very much the sofa du jour. That was very good. Billy, are you a fan of La Moog and La Musique Trippée?
It's a big yeah for me, because I'm very much a fan of that kind of, you know, sort of mid-60s French pop. I love a bit of Francois Hardy, those kind of singers. Love the kind of pop sensibility. And what's great with this album is you can hear the pop tracks they're aiming for. You know, every now and then, it's a, you know, a bit of Wild Thing comes on. Like, in the earlier stuff, it obviously, as it gets later into the 21st century, it becomes more, you know, like Air and bands like that. They're not self-referencing in a way that they used to in the 60s. But I do love that 60s pop. So they made me put this on twice in the band, so they could listen to it.
Okay.
So that was very positive. This is definitely something I would be listening to. And I don't think it fits completely into that lounge. It's more of a kind of like, I think it's more a kind of a sort of a sort of like pop is, I kind of say it in French now, pop exotique. I really love a bit of that. So, yeah, big yeah from me.
So the van says yes to yeah, yeah.
Oui, c'est très bien.
I like the van vote, yeah.
Très bien dans le van.
It may be the fact that we're all staying in the Malmaison may be having something to do with it. Isn't that French for bad house, is it?
Yeah.
Yes, it does mean bad house.
Always worries me that.
Now, Linda,
anyway,
you...
Yeah, loved it.
Wonderful. Linda, you speak French pretty fluently, and so you're going to get a lot more stuff than us. We're flicking through the Collins English-French dictionary at the time. What did you make of this compilation, Pop Psychedelic?
Yeah, it's fabulous. It's fantastic for sort of maybe someone who isn't very much au fait with the chanson française, with like with the French pop. But I think there are a couple of misses, which, I mean, I was kind of disappointed. I really like Serge Gainsbourg, obviously, but I think choosing Requiem pour un con instead of other things that are so much more sort of representative of that era is a bit weird. There is no Jacques Dutronc, which is a bit annoying, who I think is the flag bearer of the whole movement. There's also no Françoise Hardy. But then on the whole, if this brings more people into it, why not? I really like that. There's two France Gall singles in here, which is Laisse tomber les filles and which one? Oh, Poupée de cire, which are both absolutely beautiful. The only thing I can say, there's nothing in between. It says here from 1964 to...
Yeah, to, I noticed that.
There's nothing
that
in between. Where's the 70s? Where's the 80s?
Yeah. Yeah. You know? But then you've got disco, so maybe that's another compilation.
No, but there is, you know, like Claude François, Mylène Farmer, you know, like lots of other things that happened in the 90s and 80s that were really good, you know, Noir Désir, you know, things like that.
The lack of François Hardy, I didn't think.
It's bizarre. You know,
it was. Kel Fromage, we all said in the band.
But isn't that a choice, though? Because very little of it is well known, with the exception of things like CK Rock and EVA, the latest, but, you know, the more kind of dance floor-based things. Most, isn't this a kind of an easy entry, deep cuts thing, rather than, here's Françoise Hardy that you might know?
No, this is very well known. I mean, in France it is.
In France?
These songs are very... I mean, France Gall is really popular, even here, isn't she? I mean,
she's well known. She's known now, yeah.
Yeah,
she's known.
Exactly. So and Brigitte Bardot, I mean, they could.
She's quite well known. Exactly. I'll give you that.
And
she's quite well
known. I wouldn't say Brigitte Bardot is like the sort of, you know, the enfant terrible of the years.
That's true.
No, that's true.
Exactly.
Well,
the track that's on here, Contact, was a real David Holmes favourite, wasn't it? He was always playing that.
I mean, I don't know. Where is Jacques Dutronc? Where is he? He's like...
He's on the next one. He's on number two. Volume two.
Or even Pop Johnny. Johnny Hallyday.
There's a lot of this stuff.
Johnny Hallyday. Where is he?
There you go.
I mean, I'd say Françoise Hardy is just too... She's too serious. This is trying to say that, you know, here is where we get sci-fi mixed with exotica, mixed with some sort of pop music and melding it all together, rather than, you know, someone who's a little bit more austere. Andrew, what were your thoughts? Were you dancing around your kitchen to this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, miniskirt. It was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, wonderful. It is so very much the opposite of the earnestness I was just moaning about. It is the pure joy of wild, ridiculous music. Brigitte Bardot's thing about Ali Davidson is always amusing. It summons up the image of the kind of ludicrously over-the-top nightclub scene in any film shot between 1966 and 1971. Everybody is shaking their barn at the Frighten Centre. It's all 1 minute, 40-second bangers all the way
Someone
through.
Someone will say groovy in the middle of it as well, usually in an accent.
And I don't think the appeal of this stuff is camp. I think it is genuinely beautiful, genuinely exciting music. It is ambitious in the way that many of the rock bands we revere aren't ambitious. And it's that strange...
In the way that pop music can be.
Yeah.
Pop music can sort of...
And there seems to be a space in French pop music where, ludicrously, for such a long time, in, you know, the Anglophone world, it was considered that French music was rubbish and not proper. Well, how wrong can you be? There was a space for French pop to go wild. And this is French pop going wild. So I absolutely love it. I commend it to the listeners. As we come to the end of the podcast, it's time to add another tune to our roll call of the greatest songs of all time for our rolling playlist as chosen by our star guests. Billy Bragg, what are you choosing as your favourite tune of literally all time?
I'm choosing Willing by Little Feat, the second version they recorded in 1972, not the first one on their earliest album, the second one with the piano on it. And to me, it talks to me about my job. I have to do some really daft things sometimes that normally I wouldn't do. Mostly go on aeroplanes. I'm what you might call an apprehensive flyer. So on those times when I'm feeling a bit down in the dumps, you know, we're flying through the night in cloud, it's bumping up and down, the seatbelt sign's on, and I'm thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing here? How did I end up getting a job that puts me in this situation where I'm on the verge of panic here? And I think to myself, well, you know, it's because I'm willing. You know, I really want to do this job. I wanted my whole life to do this job. I'm so lucky to still be doing it in my 60s. Just, you know, it kind of grounds me, not literally, but, you know, makes me think of all the people who love to do my job. and how fortunate I am. Mm. You need that sometimes. Whatever job you have days where you think to yourself, here we go again. Mm. And that's what, so that's how I've used it. I've used it as you can use music to help me to transcend my surroundings and get me to another place where I'm a bit calmer. And that's the power that music has. Not the power to change the world, but the power to change your mood. And that's in itself a great, great power to have.
Fantastic. We'll stick it onto the rolling playlist.
So Willen by Little Feet goes on the Eternal Omni playlist. So we're at the very end of the podcast. Boo. And it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we shimmy down London's glorious Carnaby Street with pointy white boots on and a leopard print catsuit? And that's just the boys, ain't it, Linda? Linda, what's your closing time chatter?
It's something that Billy touched upon a little bit earlier regarding sort of big events and the sort of making sure that everyone is safe in those events. After the closing night of the BFI LFF, the London Film Festival, loads of sort of guests got an email saying that they'd been exposed to COVID. And I'm not putting the blame for this on the BFI at all, because it's really hard when you're organising an event that is taking place in different venues to sort of keep tabs on everything that's going on. But one thing I noticed, and which has really actually given me a little bit of sort of, I'm really disappointed in the way people have behaved, is you go to a screening or to a big screener for a gala and nobody's wearing a mask, and the staff at the venue are, but nobody's reinforcing wearing masks at all. Throughout the whole festival, I just found myself sitting next to people who didn't care, as if there wasn't a big pandemic going on. And I think it's really important to sort of start rethinking these. I know the government have completely given up on us and have refused to implement the mask mandate, which angers me more than anything. But I think venues are going to have to start taking responsibility for putting the people they want into these places. I'm actually put off going anywhere because of this, because I am very sort of vulnerable and I can't do my job at the moment because people are so selfish.
Andrew and I went to a gig this week and I never wanted to go to a gig again after that, because they didn't check for COVID and it was oversold and it was absolutely rammed like sardines. Yeah. But anyway, it is a longer conversation, isn't it? Billy, what's your closing time chatter?
Bus strikes. Oh. As I travel around the country from town to town, everywhere seems to be on the verge of or actually involved in a bus strike. Mm-hmm. We started in Dundee, where I got tapped to come down to the picket line, but while we were in Dundee, it was resolved. And the stagecoach caved in and gave the bus drivers what they wanted. Yep. There's one going on in Liverpool in the northwest at the moment, and I think it's happening in Cardiff as well, where I'm on the way there. And the reason for it is that driving a lorry pays twice as much as driving a bus. Mm. And now all the bus drivers are like, you know what? I would rather go and drive a lorry. I don't have to interface with the public and have the same problems that Linda just touched on there about people not wearing masks and getting angry when you ask them to put a mask on. You're twice as much money. You're your own boss. You can make your own time. So it's really interesting that the mixture of the pandemic and Brexit is going to put workers in a strong position to be able to bargain for rights and terms and conditions and wages in the workplace. I think that's a very interesting development.
It's been interesting. You've seen headlines on the front of the Telegraph saying things like unions to hold Britain to ransom because of pandemic. It's like, well, if you're going to kick out a huge part of the workforce, Telegraph people, you're going to find that workers and unions are maybe a bit more powerful than you, Telegraph people, want them to be.
And it's not ransom. You know, workers have the right to withhold their labour. You could, you want people to be able to bargain in the workplace for their labour. And that's the way things should be. You know, it's been wrong that it's not been like that for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's about time we got around that again. That's, again, about people giving people agency over their lives, having accountability in the workplace. So I'm really encouraged by it.
Mm. Billy's found a Brexit dividend. Who can believe it? Never happened.
Well, that's good. Positive thinking. Andrew, what's yours?
Well, I'm going to bring it right back to the trivial. Doctor Who's back on Sunday. And I am actually quite optimistic, because this has not been a good run, this producer.
And Jodie is still there, isn't she?
I think she has been given a very poor run of scripts and she hasn't been written very well. But I'm weirdly optimistic about the last six, because it's going to be a very short series because of the pandemic. And they seem to have packed in a tremendous amount of thought and reconsideration. So my fit, and of course you've got John Bishop coming in as the first ever companion from Liverpool. I think they may pull it back in the sort of last 10 minutes of the 90. I've got an optimistic feeling about this. But the interesting thing that I wanted to raise for you, Sean, and you, Ellen, this might excite you. Apparently Edgar Wright very nearly directed the pilot when this series came back in 2005. Russell Davis wanted him to direct the very first one. You can imagine what that would have been like, Doctor Who in the style of Spaced, but he couldn't do it because he was doing Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, that's interesting.
Russell Davis is back now, so Edgar Wright may get another shot at it.
I also think Edgar Wright and women also has a problem writing women.
You said, ooh, that's interesting. This other voice said, that's not interesting.
You can read me so well.
What's your closing time shout out, Sean?
Well, I have to mention that Facebook is rebranding itself as Meta. The company has dedicated £10 billion in 2021. I'm not sure exactly what bit of 2021 that is, to rebranding and researching and being the metaverse and putting out that very strange film. Did you see it yesterday?
With Mark Clegg.
Mark Zuckerberg talking remotely to Nick Clegg. Like, they were old pals, like, but also they were on TVAM.
Hello, I'm Mark Zuckerberg. I'm a human like you. Listen to me talk like a human. Here's my human face and my human hands.
I couldn't tell the CGI, Mark Zuckerberg. I was looking in the mirror.
It's, two white guys glossing over privacy problems, problems with global democracy, problems that we can't even foresee yet. I just find this absolutely incredible and so horrifying that, I mean, just even within Facebook, the safety division received £5 billion in funding. This is getting double. But think of all the money and think of what you can do with the money and think of how you could do something else with the money. And we are all addicted to this technology, and I call it an addiction. It's not a compulsion. There is something in that. It is so hard not to keep in touch with your family and your friends, and especially within the thing called the pandemic and in lockdown. We're sort of glued to this thing that we hate, and it's just, it's really difficult, isn't it?
I hate Facebook. Yeah, it's infuriating, but I think putting £5 billion into trying to detoxify this toxic enterprise that we're all stuck with, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think, you know, it's...
But putting $10 billion into getting Nick Clegg to sit in his...
I don't think Nick got the $10 billion. I think the $10 billion went on new letterheads and new business cards that say Meta, not Facebook. They're quite expensive.
They crossed it out. Absolutely. They could have crossed it out with a biro. It would cost them...
Things can only get better.
And that's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much to Mr. Billy Bragg.
Thank you. It's been great fun.
It's been wonderful. It's been an honour. Where's next on the tour? Did you say where are you going to from Birmingham today?
Southampton. Then we're over to Belfast, Dublin, Galway. I haven't got to the page in the itinerary yet. It goes on to... It finishes in the roundhouse in the last week of November.
Right. And you've got your bumper pack of COVID tests, lateral flows with you.
and the album's out today. Everything's good.
Of course. The album is out today. And thank you to Linda Marrick. We're so pleased you could join us as well.
Thank you.
From me, Andrew, producers Alex Rees and Yelena Sofronijevic, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Bye.
The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison with Sean Pattenden. The assistant producer was Yelena Sofronijevic, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune and keyboards for Billy Bragg by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.